welcome to the To Be Honest podcast. Today, I am so thrilled that I get to chat with Iman Rahman, a 23-year-old Bay Area resident since middle school who plans to share about her experience with chronic illness, being disabled, and the impact both of these have had on their mental health. Iman loves connecting with people from other cultures and is passionate about making connections through our differences. The arts have always been their outlet to release and express emotions, and art therapy brings comfort and joy through her pain. And disability has only deepened and enriched that experience. So welcome to the podcast, Iman.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. I like to ask every guest before we jump into our conversation, to be honest, how are you doing today?
I like that. To be honest, I think I've been feeling a little bit numbed out. Can't really process why at the moment, but there's a lot going on. So I think probably just my mind is processing a lot in the background, and I'm doing okay otherwise. I am happy to be here. And how are you?
Oh, thank you for asking. Yeah, to be honest, I am doing pretty well. I think I've had like a pretty busy week, so I'm a little stressed. But besides that, I am in like a good mood. I'm glad it's Friday. I'm glad the sun is shining. So yeah, I think I'm doing pretty well. Thank you so much for asking.
Of course.
So I'd love to start our conversation by talking a bit about your background. And you shared with me that you moved to the Bay Area at the start of middle school. So I wanted to know, what was that transition like for you?
It was actually really difficult. I used to be in the Midwest, and actually since preschool to third grade, I was at Montessori school, and I switched to public school right at fourth and fifth grade. So I had just kind of started that switch, which was also shocking to my system. And right when we were transitioning to middle school, I found out I was moving across, far. And yeah. I was like, oh, okay. And then I, once I got here, I realized that the district was very highly academic, and I was not prepared. I was really behind and really stressed, and it took a lot of time to adjust. I honestly don't know if I ever did. And learning from the people around me who'd grown up in the system, I think they were more used to it. Or even my sibling, they kind of, when we moved here, they started from the beginning. So I just started at kindergarten, and we're kind of getting used to the system, but it was still a lot for them too. Mm-hmm. And I think that when I look back at that, I don't think I realized how much it was affecting me. Because I was just trying to catch up. I was just trying to keep up with my peers and try to learn and, you know, learn to work with a new system that I had no idea how to navigate. And that would be the case even all through middle school and then my first year of high school as well.
I don't know if you can pinpoint, like, what was one of the major differences between, like, the culture of school in the Midwest versus the culture of schools in the Bay Area?
I think really just the focus on academics, the way that I had never heard of people taking pre-SATs in middle school. I had never been around such an environment that all the kids were focused on academics all the time. And I guess even the culture shock of being around a lot of Asian people. I wasn't used to being the majority, and I knew that that would affect the academic system just because of the culture and how we view academics. Both South Asians and East Asians were the majority, and it was a shock to be going from a community where I did not know even, I think, more than a few South Asian or East Asian people in my grade every year, to moving to a place where it was mostly those demographics.
Did it feel like a little comforting knowing you were part of the majority now, or was that still like so jarring that it was just kind of, I don't know, like not, I don't want to say uncomfortable, but just like not familiar at that point?
Yeah. So for me, I felt like it was nice because they were used to a lot of people moving in and out of the area. So I was accepted really easily, even though everyone was new in sixth grade, even if they had known each other. And there were like several different, I think, elementary schools that went into this middle school. So maybe they knew some people through outside things, but a lot of people knew each other through elementary school already. And even so, they hadn't become so cliquish that they didn't accept people that were completely new to the area, because the area is known to be, I think, a place where a lot of people are moving in and out all the time. So people are more accommodating and like really helpful with new kids. And that was really nice to see, because I've been a new kid multiple times within multiple different schools, even if it's in the same area. And I always hoped to do that for people. And it was nice to have that given back to me. And so I found that it was really nice to have that connection. And then at the same time, it was really interesting that in some ways, my community was less accepting of me than other communities, just because they assumed me to be the same as them. So there was, you know, this assumption that I would be the same level, or that my parents would feel the same way about academics as everyone else, you know, that I would be treated harshly if I did like poorly, or even just didn't get an A or didn't get 100%. So like there was a lot of differences, I think, that set me apart in that way. And people, like for me, I didn't expect them to be the same as me, but I think a lot of people expected me to have that same experience because that's all they were around. It's like a bubble. And it took me a long time to realize that, but even the teachers, I felt that way with. I had a lot of trouble with some teachers, and some teachers even like singled me out that were South Asian, that just did not know why I was struggling so much, even though they knew I was new to the area and everything. I think that it was a mix of both feeling very accepted and like the majority, and then at the same time feeling like I was treated as a minority within the majority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that would be so hard. And I know that the academic pressure impacted you. Would you mind sharing a bit about how it impacted you?
I didn't realize at the time. My parents were very aware of it, and they tried to like make sure that I had like good habits. And I think the system will, like the schools wanted to really encourage good sleep hygiene, encourage, you know, having good like nutrition, being well nourished, getting, you know, some fitness in on whatever form that may be for you. And at the same time, I think everything they expected of us made it very hard to keep those things really, like keeping it as a routine, because mm-hmm. it became really normal as I grew up to see everyone around me both wanting to have that and also having their whole life be school.
Yeah.
And so I became kind of numbed out to the fact that I was staying up past midnight in middle school to do homework.
Yeah.
And that was because I wasn't used to the system, but also because I have now realized that I'm neurodivergent and I struggle with some of those types of things. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't used to the system. So a lot of people would finish faster than me because they were used to it and they knew what could be expected. And I was just kind of thrown into it, and my family didn't really know either.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for me, it definitely started to affect my mental health. I didn't realize until I think it started affecting my physical health, but it was affecting my mental health. I just was so focused on school. I just kind of like pushed it aside, but I was definitely struggling. And so a lot of that looked like, you know, having trouble with my nourishment and not getting enough sleep, really struggling to stay awake, not feeling rested, feeling really anxious and just really just really bad about myself, like worried about, you know, my grades and how I looked according to other people around me, feeling like I had to lie even though I didn't even do poorly, or just not wanting to mention anything at all because of how, like, competitive it is. Mm-hmm. And I knew how bad that was for me, so I would really try to not do that. But it was almost so normal for everyone else to. I fell into it very easily. And I think as I struggled with that, I kind of started like shifting my friend groups and moving towards people that were not as intensely in that scene of academia. And as that happened, then I was looked at as like, you know, less smart or like less focused. And just, you know, I think a lot of people didn't know what to do with me because they're like, oh, she likes to dress up, so she must not like care about school as much. Which was really interesting because I was like, well, I can be bad things, you know? And I would both like get along with kids that didn't focus on school as much and also get along with kids who did. And at the same time, I think I was a floater who would just go in between things. And so I never really found my place. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think I struggled with the most, was being supported in those struggles by my peers, because I was a lot of that for others, because I didn't really judge those things. And my family, and I guess how I grew up, I just didn't think of doing that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get the same back, and I think that affected me more than I realized.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that has to be incredibly hard. And it sounds like you both, I mean, struggling academically is one thing, and then being looked at differently by teachers is also another like layer on top of things that just makes it so incredibly difficult to even like want to succeed, really. I mean, I can just like not relate to that, but I just know that a lot of students who don't feel seen by teachers or understood, it's just like, it's almost like, why bother if, which I don't know if that's how you felt, but that's just like the experience that I've seen a lot.
I have seen that a lot too. And I think I know a lot of people like younger than me that dealt with that.
Yeah.
But for me, I was a perfectionist. So I kind of fell into just like never feeling like it was good enough and just keep working harder, even though that was not good for me.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of that was my parents getting involved, talking to the principal, making sure that these teachers were not, you know, treating me incorrectly in a harmful way, really trying to make sure that I was not in a situation that was going to be harmful to me. And I'm really grateful for that because it was helpful to know I had that support. At the same time, I think the system was not really built in the way that they knew how to handle that, because what happened was then the teacher would assume that I needed extra help and just give me extra things to do, versus like just, you know, treating me like anyone else and just knowing that I'm struggling.
Yeah.
So it was almost like I was babied at that point. And I'm realizing now that that like really connects with how I struggle with being disabled and how a lot of people will treat me as like, you know, younger because I struggle with things. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was a form of that. And definitely that community isn't as aware of that. And I think it's very normalized to act that way. And that was a big struggle I had without realizing why at that time.
And you kind of touched on this briefly and you just mentioned it a little bit, but I wanted to do like a deep dive into when you first started experiencing physical pain and how that's impacted you as well.
I think I was experiencing it all along, but when I really started to have it impact me in a way where I couldn't ignore, I think was when I started high school. Mm-hmm. I ended up having a shoulder injury, which I now realize it was my shoulder coming out of place from a push-up, and nobody understood because, you know, in an x-ray, they're not going to see anything happened because it already moved back in place. And my PE teacher did not understand like why I could not do like a square dance unit, because they're like, even that's like really easy, you know? And I was like, well, I can't move my arm like higher than 90 degrees. So I don't think I can square dance, you know? So I had to write an essay instead. And I think like some of the impacts I had was, I had to do physical therapy I still to this day do not have the same movement in my left arm. And yeah, I never got to fully get through that because then other physical pain hit me the next year before I was able to continue that. And so when it really started, I think when it really took over a lot of my life was when I had my pain in my second year of high school, which I had moved again, only a little bit further away, but it was a completely different environment. And I think my body felt somewhat safer to just let go because I wasn't in this constant state of needing to go, 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 go. And so at some point, my body just was struggling with all this pain. It like spread everywhere. And I still have a lot of that pain. And I've kind of learned what that is recently. I struggle with joint pain and hypermobility. So a lot of my joints come out of place a lot. They don't necessarily dislocate, but there's something called subluxations, which is when it goes out and then back in again. Mm-hmm. And so that caused pain and inflammation to spread everywhere. And I was not able to go to school almost the whole second semester of my second year of high school, and it affected the rest of my high school. And as the years passed, I kind of, as a lot of people that are chronically ill, I ended up adding to my diagnoses and having more things come up, more pain come up, more conditions found, as, you know, these things were probably underlying. And sometimes I think a lot of the stress and the trauma I went through, both mental and physical, really took a toll on my body, and it couldn't handle it anymore. That was about, like, I want to say like 9-ish years ago, 8, which is really weird to think about. But I still have a lot of those things to this day. And now I'm just now starting to realize what was happening. At that time, it was really hard to explain because everyone would be like, what happened? Why are you using crutches? And it's like, I don't know. I just can't move. And to have that happen, like, was really difficult because I never realized how hard it would be to tell someone you're in pain and not have any proof of it. And I think that it made it really difficult for me to, you know, socialize. It made me very difficult. It made it difficult for me to have any normalcy around school. I couldn't attend anymore. I couldn't even go to classes online because I was in so much pain. I spent all my time going to appointments, trying to figure out what was going on. Even that was hard because I could not sit in the car, and having the bumps on the road, like, I would have to brace myself constantly. So it was just exhausting because I would just be in all this pain and I would never have a chance to not be in pain because everything hurt and nothing made it really better. So I think that's kind of what happened, and it happened all at once, and then it just kept going. Yeah. So for me, and that's not true for all people, but for me, like, that's why I think it was so easy for me to recognize something was wrong, was because, like, I could not move. I was in so much pain that it would be debilitating for me to even just move a little bit. So it was not easy to ignore once it got to that point. And then after that, I had to get involved in a lot of different things like pool therapy, acupuncture, seeing a psychologist for the first time. That was like not an option. I had to do that. My doctors made me do that, and I understand why. And so, you know, I think that I didn't realize how much I needed to see a psychologist until that happened to me, because a lot of us think that, you know, you don't need it unless you're something's wrong with you. But it can help anyone. And I think it probably could have helped me a long time ago. But the fact that they recognized I was in pain and that that would affect my mental health, I think was really life-saving for me in a way, because I was so isolated and I did not know how to navigate that situation. And it helped to have someone to like guide me that had some idea of that.
Wow, that's pretty amazing that they would recommend that. I mean, I hope most healthcare professionals would recommend a psychologist if you are experiencing chronic pain, but it's just nice to know that at a young age, they recognized that that was an important piece of your recovery. I just wanted to touch really quickly on the fact that there is such a a similar perception of chronic illness and mental health, like with the whole, I think you mentioned like invisibility factor. A lot of people, if you aren't, you know, showing symptoms in a certain moment or, yeah, essentially if you're not showing symptoms in a certain moment, it's like, does it actually exist? And I think anyone with chronic pain or mental illness is proof that yes, it is very much in existence at all times, just whether you're able to manage it or how extreme or severe it is in the moment depends on the person.
Yeah, it's such a struggle because I think like those things overlap more than people realize. Like a lot of people that have mental illness deal with physical symptoms and vice versa because they're more connected than people realize. And that's what I've learned the most.
Mm-hmm. Did you at this time feel like you had a support system? Like what was your family and your friends? I know you mentioned friends have been kind of like in and out depending on the time. So I'm just kind of curious, like what did your support system look like at that time when you were first going through this severe pain?
The biggest part of my support system, and to this day, this still is the case, was like my mom and her friends. Because I spent a lot of time with adults. I always did kind of just because I didn't always connect with my peers just from a young age. I also just liked to talk to adults. and I, especially if they treated me like my age, treated me like, you know, I wasn't little, I like really appreciated talking to them. And I think once I got sick, it helped so much to talk to adults because people my age could not relate to me because I was going through things that people could only imagine happening to older people. And also there was like this big part of me, like we were just talking about, that just didn't know how to feel about not having even proof for myself that I felt. Like sometimes I would feel like right now I would be like, oh, if I get dressed up, like I feel like a fraud for myself, not even for other people. But to myself, like I felt like uncomfortable. I didn't feel like I could recognize, like, how could I possibly be feeling so bad on the inside and not being able to tell at all on the outside, and vice versa. Sometimes I felt so, I looked bad on the outside and then I would feel okay on the inside too. So I think like that and having that happen with the support system I had was difficult for people that already had known me before. For people that had just met me when I got sick, I think it was easier because they had nobody to compare me to. They didn't know who I used to be and what I used to be like. This is true for my friends as well. And at the same time, I think there were definitely some people who I realized later had some connection to illness in their family or in their friends that understood me a little bit more, that to this day maybe are a little bit more connected and know how to support a little bit better than just, you know, assuming that, you know, you should tell the person that it's going to get better, that, I think a lot of people don't know what to say. And that's just because society as a whole doesn't know how to talk about illness or grief in general. And what we're suggested to say is just really not what most people want to hear. And even ourselves, when we go through it, realize that that's not what feels good. And so for me, having a support system, it was difficult, and at the same time, I was just grateful to have one because I knew that I could have not had anything at all. And having support with my school was really helpful because I don't think I could have gotten through it if I hadn't had that support in the same way. And then with my friends, it was hard because now it looks very different, but at the time, I was just grateful, and I think I was scared to make new friends being in the situation I was and having to introduce myself and, you know, having this whole new experience where it made it difficult to meet new people. To this day, I still struggle with that. And so, like, I think that part is hard because I probably wouldn't have been friends with those people still if I hadn't gone through that. But I held on to them because I needed to kind of have something to get me through. And I didn't really realize that it probably needed to shift until I found people that were better able to support me. And I think that was something natural that happened, but I can recognize that now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I wanted to ask about the school system specifically in general terms of what kind of support can a person expect to find from a school system for anyone who is disabled?
for me, actually, seeing the pain psychologist definitely helped me a lot. They helped me with a 504 plan and an IEP, which are things you can look into to get accommodations for, you know, maybe less homework, extended deadlines. I could leave class early so that I wouldn't be surrounded by a crowd and couldn't get through. I could go to the nurse's office without, like, having to explain.
Yeah.
You know, different things like that. You can ask for those types of things. And I think it's very individual. Like, it's based on the person and what mm-hmm. they deal with. But those things are available. And if your school does not know, and if your school is not as understanding about it, you could talk to the district a lot of the time. You can talk to maybe your medical team if you have one. It's not easy, but I'm glad that those things exist, and I was really grateful that they did. And it definitely makes it easier to navigate the system. Mm-hmm. I had, for me personally, I had, like, my counselor switch to this vice principal because I needed someone that was, like, more available and more aware of, like, the whole school system to help me get through. So, you know, there's different things that can change that you might not even know exist or can be possible, because no one will offer them until they're actually needed, and they might not even have thought of it before. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those things are based on specific situations. Like, I knew there was someone else dealing with, I think, head trauma at the time, and they were, like, trying to get both of us through something, like a program or something to get through school, and they were trying to figure out how to make it work for two different people, me and this other person. And I don't know who they were. They kept them anonymous. And I think that that was the same for them with me. And at the same time, it was nice to know that they were thinking about it. It was nice to know that they were trying to problem solve, that they were trying to learn through the people and their medical team, and also mm-hmm. keep, like, in touch with the parents. Because once I turned 18, like, I was able to do more. I did turn 18 in college, I mean, high school. Not everyone does. But once I did, I was able to, you know, tell my school when I needed to miss class and different things like that.
I'm glad that you had the support through your school, even if you did have to have your parents advocate for you. I think that's really nice that there were accommodations, as there should be. That should just be, like, a general rule. But
Right. Yeah.
And then I kind of wanted to rewind a tiny bit and talk a little bit more about your mental health during this time. So I know you experienced, like, fatigue and chronic migraines and became an ambulatory wheelchair user by the age of 16, which is a lot for someone at that age. So I just kind of wanted to understand a bit more about, like, what you were feeling during that time, some thoughts you experienced, and also, like, your friendships and, like, relationships around you and how those changed.
In terms of my mental health, I think I really didn't realize any of it until I graduated, and it just hit me that everyone was leaving and I was just not sure what was going to happen. But at the same time, when you said, yes, when I got, was 16 and all this hit me, I think right away when I realized I was not going to be able to go to school, like, it was something I didn't mention was that I really didn't like my new school. It was the opposite of what I told you earlier. Nobody talked to me on the first day of school, and I came home and I just cried. So I was like, oh, okay, this is a place where I do have to kind of put myself out there. And I am not someone that, like, really does that naturally if the area feels kind of, like, not comfortable. And everyone was really clicky, and I did make a couple of friends later on and at the end of high school. But it was really hard, and I ended up meeting people that kind of were not, did not have the best interest for me. And it was hard. So one of the biggest things people thought when I got sick was doctors all wanted to check, are you getting bullied at school? Is that why you're, like, avoiding going? And I was like, you know, I don't feel safe there. I understand what you're saying. Yes. No, I don't think I feel safe there, but I'll tell you why. And I said that. But also, I'm in pain, and that is the real thing. And I don't know how to tell you that, like, I don't like going to school, and all I want to do is go to school because I'm missing that. And that is something I didn't think I could feel. And that's how I knew that something was going on, was when I wanted to go to a school that I did not like being at, just to have something to relate to other people with. And to just have that, like, normalcy, to have that routine, to have that just high school experience, I guess. And it was like they were trying to convince me to go only for lunch, even. And I was like, well, that's the time when I sit alone, so I don't think I'm going to do that. you know, and they're like, oh, okay. Then, and so I ended up, my mom and dad helped me really try to keep in touch with people from the area I'd moved from. And they talked to me about, like, when we left that area, they promised me they would take me there whenever I wanted, because I really did not want to move. And they kept that promise. And to this day, they're still very understanding and very accommodating about my need to connect with people that maybe you're not in the same area I'm in. And I really appreciated that. So they kept in touch with some of my friends at the time's parents, really made sure that they came and visited me if I couldn't go visit them. You know, made sure that we connected, that sometimes we had little meetups. Maybe if I had an appointment, I would see someone after, like, on the way home and just have, like, a little lunch with them or something. So I think things like that made my mental health a little better. But overall, I was in so much pain and I was dealing with so much. I did not really have the capacity to, like, feel what I was going through mentally until I think it hit me once I had, like, a really bad fallout with friends over my chronic illness stuff. And then also once I realized, like, oh, I didn't end up doing SATs. I didn't end up being able to do any of that. So I have to either go to community college or I'm going to just take a break. And realizing that, hey, like, I need to breathe. Like, I got through, I graduated, and I was like, oh, I'm exhausted. And my body just got, I think it let itself go again. Like, it let itself go once I got to this school. But then it did it so even more once I graduated high school and everything hit me really hard. I struggled a lot with my mental health. But at that, like, during this time, a lot of people had told me that they would tell me, including my medical team, that they would tell me if something, if they noticed that I was struggling. What they did not realize is that it was not clear. It was not visible to a lot of people because I was numbed out. So you couldn't tell because I hadn't even processed it. So that was damaging for me because I think it took me a long time to realize how much I was struggling until the point where, you know, I was feeling unsafe with myself. I was feeling just unhappy to the point where I was, like, in tears and I did not know why. You know, there was, like, a lot of symptoms that I did not know what was happening to me. There was a point where I started realizing that I wanted to, you know, talk about seeing a psychiatrist. I wanted to talk about learning about medication because maybe there's a certain point where I should maybe need some help instead of, like, having to fight and feel like this all the time. And so I think with some of those things, it helped me realize that those things are not a bad thing, that you don't have to be at your worst to need those things. At the same time, I am very sensitive to medication, so I tend to not go there unless I really, really need it. And so that's me with everything. And so with the wheelchair thing, I was also really discouraged from using one. So I did not really realize that I could use one for fatigue, that I could use one to help with my mobility and just even just experience it more just with being out in a wheelchair until this year and, like, last year. So I say I was an ambulatory wheelchair user in the way that I did navigate things and go to doctor's appointments and use them sometimes. And one of my friends told me recently, like, Mon, but not everyone uses wheelchairs at doctor's offices. And I was like, oh, you're right. Like, I forgot, but you're right. So I definitely am a wheelchair user, even if I use it only for those things, because not everyone uses it just to get to the, I'd go through the hospital and get to the room because it's too far to walk, you know, make sure I save my energy, things like that. So recently, I think I started processing that more. I'm in the current situation where I'm like trying to get my own wheelchair. I have disabled parking now, and some of those things have helped me with my mental health, even just to know that accepting and understanding myself has not been a bad thing, has not been something sad, but something empowering for me to know that these things exist and that I'm allowed to use them, and that I will have a bigger life if I do. And that means a lot to me. Struggling with my mental health, I'm recommended by my physical therapist, my psychologist, to use those things because they want to make sure I'm not just in bed for months and not being able to leave the house if there is a way for me to, you know? And it wasn't really the specialists and things that really suggested that. They were still against it, and that's really hard mentally too. So I think one of the biggest things is the medical system itself that affects my mental health. I've recently been talked to a lot about my medical trauma. I'm currently in therapy to kind of like work through that. And just knowing how trauma affects the body and your mental health, learning through experience is not the best way to do it, but it has taught me so much. And so there's lots of different areas within mental health, I think, that I've been exploring, but it took me until very recently too, because I was so numbed out. It took me a long time to realize that I was going through medical trauma. I thought everyone just dealt with that and that was how it is. And that is true to some degree, but that doesn't make it okay. And I think sometimes we numb out because we just want to get help. We numb out because we want to get through it. And that's a coping mechanism, maybe not the healthiest, but it worked at the time. And it was really psychologists and people that realized that that was something not good for me that made me realize that, oh, you know, shock, and then just struggling with the realization of like, oh wow, like I've been going through this for this whole time and I did not even know. So I think a lot of just experiencing chronic illness in itself, being disabled as a young person in itself, it's just going to be difficult with your mental health because there's so much that it entails.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I'm glad you're at a point where you're starting to process everything that you've been through. I think, like you said, you're so focused on just getting better to a point where you feel not in pain all the time that I'm sure that the mental health side of things isn't even like a priority for you at that point. It's just like getting through either to the next day or the next appointment or to, feeling better. So like I'm glad that,
once you get to the point where things are a little bit more manageable, even for a little bit, the mental part of it hits you really hard. And this continues to happen to me every time I have a flare up, every time I have some new symptom that's like really intense for a long period of time. I forget how much I cannot feel until all of a sudden that's lower and then it hits me and I'm just like, oh wow, okay, right, I'm struggling and I have been struggling. That wasn't just me chilling out. No, I was fighting and now I can feel the effects, right? And I think that with that comes a lot of grief. For me, I think I've been grieving more than anything. And it's been really difficult because realizing all these things now, it's like an identity crisis again of just knowing like, oh, I had a shock of this happening to me, but now I have a shock of knowing that it actually was a lot more than what I already had felt it was. It's like your world turned upside down, but then turning right side up is also triggering because you don't remember what that feels like. So like feeling better sometimes or learning how to manage is also really shocking because it's like learning to get there again, but in a different body, in a different state, in a different reality than you thought you would be in. And that's just a lot to process. And I think all the time, like, why am I so tired? Why am I sleeping all the time? Why am I so emotional? It's like, well, you have a lot going on. You've had a lot going on. And the fact that you're thinking and having all this going on in your mind, it's no wonder that this is affecting you even when you can't feel it. And then at some point you'll feel it again. And so I think that's why earlier when I said I'm numbed out and I can't really feel why, it's a lot of this. It's a lot of knowing, you know, what I've told you about my past, what I'm telling you about what's going on now, and even just thinking about the future, you know, and knowing that, you know, in 3 years, I'm going to be kicked off of insurance and I'm trying to get disability. You know, all these things that people my age are not really necessarily thinking of for the same reasons. You know, there's like grieving milestones that I didn't achieve and like grieving having to reach milestones that I didn't expect to be at, but also the joy of knowing that those milestones have brought me more life, more connection, more community. Disabled joy is bittersweet. It's always going to be bittersweet because it's not going to be something you'd experience unless you're in this situation, which is not great in itself. Mm-hmm. But there is still joy. And I think that's been something that really helps me with the mental health aspect is finding that community and finding that joy.
Yeah, because I'm sure at, 15, before you experienced all these symptoms, you didn't think that your life path would probably be leading you to where you are today. But it is nice to see this like pivot that you've taken to finding like the positives and the benefits of being in the position that you are, which I think is like a great transition to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is like how you became a part of the disabled advocacy community. Like, how did you seek that out? And what does being an advocate look like?
So for me personally, I didn't really know. I kind of just started to share a little bit about me. I think when around the 5-year mark of dealing with things, I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to start talking about this because now I have a little bit more information that I can actually like talk about it. It was hard to talk about something I didn't know what was going on and what I was feeling. But once it got to like 5 years worth of going through it, I was kind of like, okay, let me try. So I started off with just sharing it with my family and friends. A very few of them that I felt comfortable with and that I had already known some of my journey. And when I realized that that wasn't really what I needed and what I needed was community, I started connecting with more people that had those experiences themselves and were already advocates. So I started switching my, I guess, audience to more people in the community and helping each other out because, you know, rather than trying to educate people, which was exhausting and that I had to do all the time anyway, this was meant for me to be connected, to be, to not have to explain and just say how I'm feeling without having to back it up or prove myself, just having to just saying what I felt. And that was really freeing. That became a really good outlet for me. And at the time, I almost posted like every day because I just had so much going on those past years and it really helped to kind of like connect. And I ended up growing really fast. I did not expect that to happen. But once I decided to kind of put my account on public and connect with multiple different sources and audiences, like within, I guess, the eating disorder community, within the disabled community, within the chronically ill community, within like mental illness, you know, lots of different things. I grew a connection with multiple different people and people with intersectional identities like mine. And it helped me, I think, understand myself. It helped me understand who I was before when I was a kid, why I went through what I did, what I was feeling, and how other people did too. And knowing that not everyone did, but also that there are lots of people out there that do understand my journey. And so I think a big part of it was really just wanting to be the person that I never had for myself and hoping that it helps someone out there. And also people that continuously on the day-to-day basis deal with things like me. And being that community for each other that we do not have. I recently started forming a team with some of the people I've met online. And I'm going to be making a page meant for like queer, neurodivergent, disabled, chronically ill patients of color, specifically for that group of people. Everyone on the team like goes under that group. And we're calling it Dear Disabled because we want it to be like a letter or like a space for people to feel like this is for you. and both to uplift them and to share their space, but also to talk about our own stories and our own connections and the things that we feel like are missing in a whitewashed community, like anything else, like maybe cultural background, the fact that there's a lot of inaccessibility in language, you know, lots of different areas that I think are kind of left out of conversations because we're only this much there. But, you know, for the people that are already interested in more than that, we wanted to make sure that we know that we're not for everyone. And who did we want this audience to be for? We wanted it to be for the people that want a little bit more information that maybe relate to these things that are not as openly talked about. And so I'm really excited. I feel like I found a community and like a group of people that are like my specific circle and become like these few people that I can be with and share and talk with, but not like without, I guess, pushing past my limits, having my boundaries respected and vice versa. So I think for me, an advocate looks like being that for others, but also remembering that others need to be that for you too. And that it's important to keep that in mind and change anything as those things are pushed or, you know, you notice a change. And I think a lot of that goes with just saying nothing sometimes and listening and processing and not constantly being someone putting out content, because that's just not how my brain works. I don't know how to say something when I don't have anything to say. Sometimes I know someone else is meant to say something. Maybe someone else is meant to share the story and it's not my thing to say. And I think I'm really wanting to give that space to more people than just me. And if I have a platform, give that platform to people that maybe don't have one or don't have as much of a reach and different things like that. Because I think that a lot of people want to share. A lot of people need a space where even just people have shared things, even if they're not sharing their own, just to relate to. And knowing that I've done that, I know there's probably other people too. And I just want to give other people that chance.
That's really, honestly, you said so many amazing things. Yeah, I just wanted to thank you, one, for creating a community and creating that space for people. I think that's incredible and definitely needed. So I hope we can help promote that space for people once this podcast comes out. And I just love that you also have created boundaries for yourself within when you were exploring communities that already existed or creating your own. I don't know if this is like a general feeling, but I think sometimes when we try to find our community, I think we have this feeling like we have like, oh, these people have the same identities as me. So like we must like be the same or like I must fit in with them. But sometimes like there are people like you won't click with or like people that are not going to be good influences within those communities. So I think, like you said, creating those boundaries and just making sure you're finding like the right people that you feel safe with is so important. So I appreciate you kind of talking about that and exploring that. So
yeah, it was really important for me to recognize too. I think I didn't do that as much before. I always wanted to put other people first. And I have had lots of people tell me like, you have to put yourself first before you can help anyone else. Like that's the best way to help people, is to help yourself first. Otherwise it's not going to, it can only go so far. And I think once I really had the physical effects of my body and my mental health and everything making it so that I realized that, it forced me to really take that into consideration and realize that that is something serious. And that stress and like, you know, being overwhelmed and things like that can really be detrimental to your health. And that's not worth it in any situation, you know, no matter what you're doing. And so I think like putting myself first, regardless of what was going on, regardless of what situation I was in, just became something that I started to go towards. You know, like rest is something I'm very, very like strong about. I just really want people to know that rest is important. So myself, I'm also going to be resting. I'm not going to be talking about rest all the time. I'm going to also be resting, you know? And I think that that helped me to kind of make sense of things. And I'm still learning. We're all still learning. And I think one of my favorite things is connecting with people who are always open to learning more and knowing that there's more out there and that we don't know everything, because that's, I think, the best type of advocacy there is being open-minded and knowing that we're not going to have all the answers and other people do too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I want to end on kind of a more joyful note. I mean, the advocacy stuff is so joyful, but I also want to talk about some of like your passions beyond that, which are poetry and dancing. So I was hoping you could share a bit about, well, one, how you got into writing poetry, and then I'll ask more questions later about dancing.
So for poetry, I actually loved writing as a kid, and I kind of forgot that until recently. I decided to try art therapy because I just wanted to fight this thing that I've always had a block with art. I've always thought I wasn't an artist. I always thought I'm not good enough. I don't think that this makes sense. I'm not good enough to consider myself artistic. And so I decided to start art therapy, and going in, I was so anxious, and it still is uncomfortable sometimes, but it reminded me of how I felt as a kid before people told me that my writing wasn't good enough, before people told me that I had to write a certain way to be a good writer, that I had to be a certain level of, I guess, have a certain like level of vocabulary. I don't know, all those different things. And I think poetry is one of those accessible forms for me where there's a lot of things where like a lot of rules don't exist. Maybe punctuation, maybe spelling, maybe it just was more accessible for me. And so to find disabled poets, to find disabled writers, to find disabled artists is really what got me there. But also I think my art therapist giving me assignments and me leading into words versus just art of just pictures. And so remembering how much words mean to me and how they've always meant a lot to me, how they've always made sense of life and how I view the world. And so basically I just came back into that really deeply. And I think through going through things like this that I've described, I had a lot to say. I had a lot of feelings, and sometimes they don't make a lot of sense. I don't know what to say. And so I end up sharing it in a way that is not what I'm like feeling, but maybe a specific situation. Like I talk about me feeling deep in one of my poems where I talk about being too deep for people. I talk about the ocean. I talk about, you know, being on the shore versus being immersed in water and how that feels versus just saying that I feel deeply. And I think sometimes when I was able to give a voice to how I was feeling and my self-expression through my pain, through this journey, it helped me to know it for myself, because seeing it on paper or seeing it in front of me like helped me, but also it helped me to share it with other people if I felt comfortable to, you know, explore vulnerability in a way that I didn't have to say anything in words. And sometimes it was vague and you could take lots of different things from it. People can take different parts. And I think that's how I've always been, like, in terms of writing and art, just wanting to put it out there for me. And then if anyone connects to it, if I decide to share, maybe them recognizing something in that about me or something about themselves or others. And like lots of people can get different things out of it. And that's why I love poetry specifically, I think, because it's like you can kind of interpret it in many ways. And that's how I feel as a person.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. I love poetry too. Like you said, the fact that there are no rules really, or like rules, I guess, just makes it so easy for anyone to try out if they're wanting to. So I think it's such a, like, right, a beautiful like entry point too to expressing yourself. So I encourage anyone out there to just like pick up a pen and paper and try out writing poetry for, you know, for an afternoon if you're feeling any type of way. And then I also wanted to ask about your experience with dance, because I know you've been a dancer for a long time. So now you're also part of the disabled dancing community. So I wanted to just like ask about your experience with dance in general, and also now being part of the disabled dancing community.
Yes. So I've been dancing since I was 5. Well, that's when I started taking classes. I think I probably started dancing before that. It's always been a big part of my life. It's on, like, it's within my family. A lot of my family dances. Music is a huge thing in my family. So it was just in my blood. Dance has always been a part of my life. It's always meant a lot to me. And at the same time, I think it was more just for me personally. And no one ever knew that more than, I think, as I grew up, less and less people knew that, because I wasn't someone to show that in public. And maybe at like a wedding or an event, you'd see me just dancing and having fun. But only once I kind of connected with the disabled dance community and started seeing people, I guess, finding movement in accessible ways, and specifically this one series on Facebook through Nia Sue, who is a dancer from Dance Moms. And I didn't know this, but she has a disability herself. So she started a series and had a different disabled dancer on each episode, and I ended up reaching out to some of them, and I ended up, now they're some of my friends and community, and it was incredible because some of them really connected to my story. I was like, or I connected to their story. I remember seeing someone talk about not being able to dance, and so they imagined their steps in their mind while just laying in bed. You know, some of the conditions people dealt with are also some that I do. And, you know, it was just incredible to witness and hear them speak about it, have their passion for dance, and not be treated as less for the fact that they're disabled. And for me, I think I always felt really uncomfortable about being a dancer once I became more chronically ill, because I felt like if I was sick, then how can I dance? You know, that doesn't mean that, that means I'm probably well enough to dance, so I can't call myself chronically ill. But I think this helped me connect with the fact that you can be chronically ill and do lots of different things. And, you know, you never know what people are going through. As cliche as it is, it's just true. And I think that I judged myself really harsh because I wanted to make sure I didn't come off as a fraud, because I felt like one, and people also called me one in many ways. And I think once I kind of let go of that and just was so happy to have a connection with dance again and to be able to move in any way, I just wanted to choose that over having to worry about anything else. And so I started dancing, and I ended up seeing this specific magazine, which I actually am a part of now. But basically, they're a magazine for creatives called Wishbone Words and chronically ill disabled creatives and artists. And they asked me, you know, we want to do a video with different people dancing. And so I made a video for that. And I gave them a little clip. And then I decided, you know, maybe I'll share a little bit more for my, like, on my page. And then I did. And it was the first time I'd really shared dancing in that way with anyone outside of someone who'd seen my recitals when I was little, outside of someone who maybe had seen me dancing for fun just at a friend's house. And it was really incredible to see people connect to my emotion that I had in my dance, to, I guess, to be known as a dancer now to by so many people is incredible, because that happened more after I took dance classes than before. And just to have a different perspective, I guess, of what a person is and why that people consider them such. You know, I'm not considered a student because I'm in school, but I'm considered probably more, I've been called an eloquent speaker more often than when I was in school, which is just so funny to me, because I'm like, I'm always tripping over my words. But I think, you know, having to navigate the medical system, I had to learn how to advocate for myself. And I had to learn to spend time on joy and finding things that made me happy, that I could connect with. And so all those things, I think, meant more to me, and my passion stood out more, and my messages were just deeper, and I didn't know that. And so I felt like people knew me more as a person now than ever before. And so that was probably the thing that I never expected, was that I would feel so much more myself, and people would view me more as who I actually was than when I was not as sick, which I think is something people don't think about, and something I never thought would be possible, and something that really has made such an impact on me and my journey.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that you have kind of expressed yourself fully, in a sense. Like, you, you've shown people so many different sides of you in such a vulnerable way. And I just love that you have gotten back into dance now that you're at a point where you feel like you can, and also you've connected with people who are part of this community that support you and want to see you like thrive and succeed. So I just think the whole experience is so, so wonderful. So thank you so much for sharing. And I just want to also just thank you for being on the podcast in general. I think it's amazing that you're here sharing your story. And I want to give you a chance to share where people can go to learn more about you. I know you mentioned your new page and a few other things. I just want to give you an opportunity to list them all now if you would like to. And we can also include the information in our episode show notes so people can click on links and stuff.
Yeah, I will definitely send you more information on show notes, just because I know spelling and things can be confusing. But you can find me on my pages on all social media platforms. At Dear Disabled and at A Little Bit of Faith. And I am always happy to talk to anyone and, you know, connect, or, you know, if you feel like there's something that you want to share, feel free to reach out. I will always get back to you as I can. And also I have my emails linked to those platforms as well. So thank you so much for giving me your platform to share that as well.
Of course. Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing your experience. I think it'll definitely impact so many people in such a positive way. So I just appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. But I hope we can stay connected, and you can check in soon and let me know like how things are going. But until then, I hope you take care, but we'll talk soon.
You too. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the To Be Honest podcast. We are incredibly grateful for your support over the last 4 seasons and look forward to sharing even more personal mental health journeys and stories in the future to help normalize the conversation around this topic. To Be Honest is a program of Momentum for Health that encourages youth and young adults ages 14 to 25 to express themselves through creative media and seek help in times of need. If you or a loved one is looking for behavioral health services, please call 988 to locate options available in your area. Season 4 of the podcast is hosted and edited by me, Avery Cruz. We'll also be incorporating a few special episodes into the season, created and recorded by a handful of our Youth Advisory Board members who will be introduced in future episodes. The podcast theme music was created by Julia Steele. To learn more about the To Be Honest program, please visit www.tobehonest.today and follow us on Instagram for the latest news at tobehonest.today. Bye!